living in character. When I think of character, I think of characters on the stage. After all the world is a stage, and we merely players. And I think about a nightmare. And I've referenced the play, An Actor's Nightmare, before, but not at this level of examination. I have and had a recurring nightmare for most of my life that I'll get to in a moment. But I remember sitting in a play, The Actor's Nightmare by Christopher Durang, and being so happy that I wasn't alone in my nightmare, that somebody else obviously had the same recurring fear and dread. What happens in an actor's nightmare is a man shows up to be part of the audience at a play. And the stage manager greets him by name and says, "George, I'm so glad you're here. Oh, the lead is sick and you're going to have to go on." And he said, "My name's not George. I'm not an actor. I'm just part of the audience." "Ah, no. You're George Spelman." And there's a little inside joke, because Georgina Spelman, I'm sure none of you know, was the porn star in The Devil and Miss Jones. Already there is a literary allusion here for the condescending and the guilty. So George is told, "You have to go on." "I'm not an actor. I don't know what's going on." Stage manager doesn't take it seriously and pushes him onto the stage. And you can see him bewildered by the bright lights. It's like a birth experience when you're born into hell and you have no idea what's going on. He doesn't know what the play is. He just sees people who are very well dressed, in tuxedos, the men, and women in gowns, on the balcony of a hotel. And they are engaging in brittle repartee. And before he knows it, we, of course, being educated theatergoers, understand immediately, well, it's some kind of Noel Coward play. Because nobody else dresses in tuxedos and gowns and does brittle repartee on the balconies of hotels. And pretty soon, our disoriented guy kind of figures out, well, it is a comedy of manners, and seems to be English, so he tries to respond to what's going on, and he stops talking in an English accent, but not a very upper class Noel Coward accent, but slowly he becomes a little more sophisticated, and his posture a little more straight, and his dialogue a little arch, and his accent becomes fit upper class, so that you also, at the other end of the English spectrum, you can't understand him either. Just as he starts to catch on to, well, it must be Pride of Lives or Hay Fever or something, just as he starts to look comfortable, the lights go down, the lights come back up, and all of a sudden, it's clear everything has changed. There are two characters, and they are in trash cans. Now, again, the educated theatergoers, the sophisticated, understand that we are dealing with Samuel Beckett here, and that it is either Endgame, or Waiting for Godot, or some combination of the two that gets referred to eventually as Checkmate, which is a play on Ben about the Endgame. And they're in clownish makeup, and the plot doesn't seem to make an awful lot of sense, and the dialogue is hardly intuitive, and it does not, the exposition is not at all linear, because it is, we know, and he is just coming to realize, it is theater of the absurd. Oh yeah, I've been there too. And just as he kind of figures out, well, look, I don't have to make sense. It's, you know, like theology. It doesn't have to be logical. It just has to not even be coherent now that I think about it. But just as he becomes comfortable with the chaos, the lights go down and Hamlet seems to break out. And now that's a problem. Because again, being an educator, there's a reason if you can't figure out the logic of Samuel Beckett, who wrote in French and native speaker of English, who wrote in French and then translated it back into English and wanted it to be absurd, successfully. But you're supposed to know Shakespeare and Hamlet. And he, as most of us would be, was at a loss. He knows the story, but he can't summon up the lines. And he engages in the following monologue. And the monologue, every once in a while, he yells lines. Because as an actor, if you do go off on your lines, and you yell lines, there's supposed to be somebody off stage that gives you the line. So off he wanders into the spotlight, knowing that he's Hamlet. And of course, he starts very securely, not knowing what act it's in, but starts securely nonetheless. To be or not to be, that is the question. Line? What a rogue and peasant slave am I. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind's eye to kill oneself, or not killing oneself, to sleep a great deal. We are the stuff the dreams are made of, and our lives rounded by a little sleep. Oh, thrift, thrift, Horatio, neither a buyer nor a lender be.
Still dead on stage and doesn't get to take a bath.
That is the actor's nightmare. Mine is a little bit more benign. I die frequently on stage, but that's another issue. Mine has always been the same play, Death of a Salesman. And when I first had it, I showed up at the theater, and they said, "You're on, you're playing Biff." Now when I have it, "You're on, and you're playing Willie." I have recast myself almost age appropriately. But it is changed me to understand that I'm actually too old to play Willie. I don't know how that happened either. But I have the same conversation with the stage manager. "You're going to go on." "But I'm not an actor." "Well, do you know the play?" "Well, yeah, I know the play. I'm educated. I know the play." "Well, do you know the character?" "Yeah, I know the character."
Yes. One of the pieces of wisdom that I have learned painfully over the years is to try to be honest in most situations, not in all situations. You need to deal with the maximum of the action sometimes. But when I have made a mistake, it is usually pretty easy for me to own it and to say I'm sorry. Not simply in the passive voice, mistakes were made, but to talk about what my intentions were. And, you know, the good news for me, and this, I know, sounds the structure of a joke, but it's absolutely true, is I've had enough experience in making mistakes and in apologizing that it doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt. Being stubborn and always right and having to win the argument doesn't work well in most people's lives. Two of my friends whom I respect with just respect amazingly, they're both judges and they have judicial temperaments, and one of the things that made them both wonderful judges is that they were not judgmental. Is that if they took a position, whether it was a legal position or a social or a political position, and you could talk them through a different logic, they wouldn't hang on out of stubbornness. Being able to be wrong and admit it is a great gift. It's so hard to protect yourself if you insist that you don't make mistakes. It raises the bar so high and lowers your credibility so low, and those are lose-lose situations. I asked what the question meant. And what was the pain about? And what the pain was about was what this person said, and this is now 40 years ago, and two congregations ago, and you can't possibly find this person, I'm not even identifying by gender. What this person said is, "My Christian friends tell me that if I take Jesus into my heart, I won't be lonely or frightened anymore." And I said, "I completely understand that. And if that is something that happens for you, I completely support it. And if that is not something that happens for you, then let's talk about what we can do today to fill your heart and to deal with issues of fear and loneliness." And I think I would say the same thing today, but I wouldn't have been as flummoxed or have needed at that time. I smoked the pipe to fill the pipe, light it, damp it, light it again, puff, and then respond in an Irish accent. It was Blake who called acting the divine hypocrisy. We do, in Eliot's terms, prepare a face to meet the faces that we meet. The question is of whether the mask is authentic. Of course we do hide it. Of course we don't tell all of the truth all of the time. We can't, we shouldn't, it's not an idea. We should know what the truth is, but it's a reason that we talk about compensating, and somebody who has lost the ability to compensate is decompensated and they've gone nuts. There are occasionally, I'm just going to guess, people who from time to time might get bored or annoyed by a sermon. Almost no one,
I'm not going to look at anyone in particular,
almost no one stands up and screams, "Why is this God stuff? I've never heard this sentence in my life." Most of us can pretend from moment to moment to be civilized. When I was working in the mental hospital in Napa, my Eisenberg said to me one of the most valuable things. I had made the remark that it was hard to tell the difference between the patients and the staff, and myself included. And he said, "You're no different from them. You still have the capacity to act sane. And some people have become too tired or disoriented or through whatever means or chemical or genetics can no longer compensate for what's going on around them. They become emotionally immediate and aren't necessarily in touch with their motivations and with what it is that you do in polite society. Most of my madness I am in touch with and I don't act out. And it's a choice. Am I being inauthentic? No. I'm being part of a social contract that surrenders some of my mad spontaneity for being able to live with people." Well, that's true. And it's true that that's why in examining life, you can't simply trust your instincts, because not all your instincts are good. And that image is used actually in Western religions beside Manichaeism as part of that sense that we are drawn in several directions. And the way that you decide is to be, exactly as Ed said, mindful. Mindful of who we are and whether this action enhances our values or whether it is just something short-term and immediate.